All right. Yeah, we finished the first four chapters, and so we are going to we're ready to start chapter four, and the video series, this is where it's got another session. So we'll start out with that, and then we'll get started into the material. There we go.
Echo 537 was pretty interesting.
The first several chapters of Revelation introduce people to the book by first of all asking people to take a look at who was the book written for. And we found that it was written for Christians living in different kinds of situations. Some were persecuted, some were complacent, some were just trying to get along without letting their faith interfere with the rest of life. In those first few chapters, after John has taken us on a tour through these seven churches and the various challenges facing them, John introduced us to God seated on the throne and invited readers to join in that heavenly chorus singing praises to the one true God. In Revelation chapter 5, John has somebody else that he wants his readers to meet. It's not the dragon or the beast, but rather John wants his readers to meet Christ. And before John will let readers get any further along, he wants to introduce them to who Christ is. Now, when we read along in chapter 5 of Revelation, and we find that God is seated on the throne holding a scroll in his hand, John sees the scroll and assumes that that is God's will for the world that is inscribed on the scroll. The problem is that no one can open the scroll. No one has been found worthy to do so. There's a search made. No one can be located until someone tells John, look, that the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. Now, when John hears this, he is hearing about a Lion of the tribe of Judah. Revelation is using picture language. This is a great opportunity for us to think a bit about how Revelation communicates using these word pictures. When John is introduced to the Lion of the tribe of Judah, when he hears one of the elders in heaven speak about the Lion, this brings images to mind. You don't have to be a specialist in biblical studies to know that a lion connotes things like strength or majesty. A lion is the king of the beasts. It's one of the strongest animals. It's the image that was often associated with kingship, both in Israel and in other countries. When John hears about the Lion of the tribe of Judah then having conquered, he has visions of strength and majesty going through his mind. Now the question is, what will John see when he turns around to get a good look at this lion? Here's where Revelation makes a surprising move. In Revelation chapter 5, verse 5, John hears the promise that God is sending a lion to conquer the root of David. And David, of course, was one of the great kings, one of the great lion-like kings in Israel's history. But when John turns around to see the lion, in chapter 5, verse 6, what he sees is not a lion, but a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered. Now this creates a different set of word images, word pictures. If the lion connotes strength, the lamb usually connotes weakness. If the lion is the king of the animals, the lamb is one of its meekest members. If the lion preys on other animals for its food, the lamb who was slaughtered is a victim of sacrifice. John hears about the lion, but what he sees is the lamb. And in juxtaposing those two images, in using those two word pictures to introduce us to Christ, John conveys something about who Christ is.
Have any of you seen the movie Chronicles of Narnia, the first one?
I think we did.
Does this sound familiar? Aslan, the lion, who lays down his life so that the others might be saved. Yeah. I said, nothing new under the sun. We find things in interesting places.
He is the one in whom God's promise concerning strength and leadership is fulfilled, but the way in which the promise is fulfilled is by sending the Lamb, by sending Christ crucified. God keeps the promise of the lion by sending the Lamb. God keeps the promise of someone to build the kingdom by sending his Son to be crucified. This gives us a glimpse into the way in which Revelation communicates through its word pictures. When we turn to chapter 6, we find John hearing about the four horsemen. John will hear about the Lamb opening each of the seven seals on the scroll that he received from God. And when he does so, opening each one of the seals in turn, a horseman appears. The first horseman is a rider on a white horse who comes out conquering and to conquer. Now, one of the most famous illustrations of all of this was done by Albrecht Dürer, who created a vivid woodcut showing the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Dürer is a helpful aid, I think, in biblical interpretation. You'll notice when you see Dürer's woodcut that the first horseman, the one who's riding on the white horse and holding a bow, is at the far end of the picture, the one farthest away from you as a viewer. That's because conquest is what this horseman represents, and conquest has to do with a threat around one's borders, the threat of having one's borders overrun by a foreign power. You'll note that Dürer, when he moves to the second horseman, comes a step closer to you as a viewer. You'll find that the second horseman represents violence. This horseman holds a great sword above his head. The horseman represents the kind of violence that people do to one another. That's clear in the description. He was given a great sword that people might slaughter one another. This is no longer simply talking about the conquest of one nation over another, of having one's borders overrun by a foreign power. Here we find the violence that occurs even in our own communities, the violence that people do to each other. When you come to the next horseman, this one represents economic insecurity. You'll find that this horseman holds a pair of scales or balances in his hand. We often think of them, as Dürer portrays them, associated with the justice system. But for Dürer, he was portraying the economic system. People had to use balances or scales. When they did commerce, you would weigh out a certain amount of goods for a certain amount of money. This horseman talks about the economic ups and downs in people's lives and the threat of economic hardship. A voice comes along with this horseman declaring that it would take a whole day's pay of a denarius in order to buy a quart of wheat or 3 quarts of barley. Well, a quart of wheat would be about what it would take to feed one person for a day. 3 quarts of barley, you might be able to feed a small family, although it wouldn't be much. What that means is that you're spending your entire day's paycheck simply to put a little bread on the table. You're not starving, but you're living on the edge. Economic insecurity. The last horseman represents death. It's the one that Dürer puts at the front of his picture. It's the one that you might not see right away when you look at it, but it's there in the front, and it brings the threat up into your lap. The fourth horseman is finally one that nobody escapes. Death finally comes to all. Now, what's interesting about the four horsemen is that even the most futuristic interpreters assume that the four horsemen represent threats. Everybody agrees that we're not supposed to look for CNN to capture a rider on a white horse with a bow charging down Pennsylvania Avenue in order to signal that the end of the world is at hand. Everybody agrees. that these horsemen represent threats. The question is what kind of threats they represent. I think that the threats that we see in the four horsemen were threats that John's first readers would have said are real. Conquest, violence, economic insecurity, death. For the people in the seven churches, those threats were real. We can ask ourselves, do those threats remain real for us? I think the answer would be yes. For the generations in between, John's time and our time, the same answer would be true. They've been threatened by conquest, violence, economic insecurity, and death as well. John's imagery works by pointing to things that are real, but are difficult to put on a timeline. They convey things that unsettle us, disturb us, in order to awaken us to just how tenuous life in the world can be. As you make your way through Revelation chapter 6, you'll find the threats simply increasing in intensity as you move from one seal to the next and the next. By the time you've moved through seal number 5 with its vision of the martyrs and to seal number 6, where you find the earth quaking and you find the mountains falling and you find the sky becoming dark and the stars falling from the heavens, people finally begin crying out with a question. Who can stand? And that's a great question. That's exactly the kind of question Revelation wants you to ask. Who can stand in the face of these kinds of insecurities? Rather than opening up the seventh seal, Revelation has an intermission in which, now that a good question has been asked, who can stand, an answer is given. There are angels that hold back the forces of destruction until the servants of God can be sealed on their foreheads. And now John hears about the number of the sealed, 144,000. Here John is again using some of his picture language, the 144,000. They come from every tribe of the 12 tribes of Israel. 12,000 from each tribe. Now the question is, John has only heard about these people. He has not yet seen them. He's heard about God preserving, sealing a group out of the 12 tribes. But when John turns to get a good look at them, down in verse 9, what he sees is not 144,000. What he sees is a countless multitude from every tribe and tongue and folk and nation. The promise of the 144,000 is a promise about God preserving a remnant out of the people of Israel. What he sees in the countless multitude is the way in which God keeps that promise by calling people from the 12 tribes, but not stopping there, calling people from every tribe. Saving 144,000, yes, but not stopping with 144,000, saving a countless multitude. Just as God promised the lion and fulfilled the promise by sending the lamb, God promised to keep to a remnant of the people of Israel, but kept the promise in a way that exceeds anything that people could have imagined. What you find in Revelation chapter 7 is that that again is an occasion for praise. You find the people around the throne singing salvation to God who sits on the throne, let all cry aloud in honor of the Son. Words again that have been set to music. The verses of the hymn, "You servants of God, your master proclaim," is a familiar way that in which these words have inspired Christians in many generations to continue worshiping. If the vision of the four horsemen unsettles people, the vision of the great multitude encourages us to focus our worship on God, who truly has the power to save. When we lift up our voices with those in the vision, Revelation is having the effect that it was designed to have, drawing us into that same group of worshipers that we find in the text. Some things that I'd like you to think about, questions to ask. Think about the four horsemen and put yourself in the position of those first readers of the book of Revelation. How would they have been threatened by economic insecurity or death, conquest or violence? Ask yourself how your parents or grandparents faced those same threats. Then ask yourself, where do you see those threats today? After you've done that, then ask yourself, how does being claimed by God give you a way to stand? Even though those threats are real, how do the being claimed by God, give you a way to stand in the face of them and to find joy in knowing the God who has claimed you and redeemed you.
Okay, the DVD breaks different places. This book is chapters 4 to 7. That one is 5 to 8. So, and we're ready to start chapter 4. So that's a little bit ahead, but the DVD is easier to play here than it is at St. Martin. So, what do you hear there? What questions does it raise?
Well, I watched this. A story would come under the second horseman. A guy and his girlfriend were on this guy's big boat, and they were doing drugs. And all of a sudden, the guy just picks up a hammer and beats the guy to death with it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't steal his money or anything off the ship. He took his credit card just to get away from the police. For about a week, they made it from motel to motel before they caught up with them. Naturally, he went to jail, and they interviewed the guy, and he said, I didn't kill him for any particular reason, but if it wasn't him, I would have killed somebody else. I'm just wired that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's unfortunately true.
Well, I see all of history, is what he's saying, basically.
Yeah, yeah. It's easy on the one hand to say that all the things talked about in Revelation are future things yet to come. And yet, we can also see where they've already happened. As he said, the threats of war, of famine, economic insecurity, death, those things exist all around us and always have in different forms. And for each generation, I'm sure we can find different things that represent all of those. Certainly during that time, when they were still under Roman occupation, when there were other powers that were trying to overthrow Rome, the threat of war was always there. And of course, anytime you're threatened by war, especially when you're an occupied country, any war is going to disrupt commerce, the ability to grow food. You know, armies coming through tend to steal what you have in the way of food and burn the rest. So, all of those things are very real threats. I mean, just think of stories you've heard of the Civil War here. Sherman came through the South and he made sure that there was nothing left behind him. And every general we've ever heard great stories about has done the same thing. It's one of the things in the art of war. Don't leave your enemy anything with which to rebuild. So, yeah, I mean, very true that those are part of our history in multiple ways.
Well, I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard the people that make missiles and weapons and sell them to other countries to have a war and then tear the country apart, then they own the people that go back in and rebuild it. So they make money twice.
There are some concerns about that. That some of, especially it's been true with the war in Iraq, that some of the same companies that have provided mercenaries, independent security forces, are also the companies that are providing the people doing the rebuilding. So yeah, there is some truth in that. There is great money to be made in war.
Yeah.
As long as you're on the winning side.
Yeah.
But there's great money to be made in war, which is, and I think Reagan probably said it as well as anybody, I mean, there's this great machine in this country that's geared towards war, whether we like it or not. And trying to shut it down is hard. Very hard.
Well, Nixon
You know that because we were in depression. World War II come along, everything got good, and right after we almost went in another depression.
Mm-hmm. I've always heard that whenever you want to make some money in the country, go to war.
Yeah. Well, as long as you win. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's there have been many millionaires made throughout the world, or their equivalent, through the art of war making.
Yeah, well, we haven't won a war since World War II.
Wow. We haven't lost.
No, yes, we have.
No, we haven't been conquered.
We haven't conquered in time, but we haven't won.
Well, no, we didn't let them. They didn't let us win in Nam.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And we lost. We had troops in Korea that's still ongoing. We still got 30,000 troops in Korea. We got 40,000 to 50,000 troops over in Japan. Yeah.
We were talking about Germany. Sherman coming through and all that stuff. What happened? Look at Germany. Look at Japan now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The economics are
way up. Well, I mean, it doesn't mean that they'll never rebuild, but the whole point of what Sherman did was to make sure that they could not immediately rebuild and come after him. He left them no food, no supplies, nowhere to hide. That's what happens. So the Four Horsemen certainly represent all of those things, and particularly in time of war. I mean, death, famine, lack of income, all those things. Certainly, violence, and of course, especially in the aftermath. I mean, those fighting for survival is probably the violence there could be as bad or worse than what the soldiers did when they came through.
And I never really looked at it as the Revelation being a part of our lives.
Yes.
For generations, I've always assumed that the Revelation was the end of times for everybody. But apparently, it's really not. Uh-oh. It's the end of times for...
like history to me.
Yeah, it's the end of times for a lot of different people at different times, but not for everybody.
Yeah.
I like to think of these horses and their colors as they were talked about earlier in Zechariah, the same four colors. And the Greek word there, instead of pale, is chloric, which is green. In that original text, where I'm listening to some other things, what I've learned of Revelation. And the guy throws out a theorem like white. You see a bow, but you don't see the arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And you conquer without the arrow. And that's, if you look at the history of the Catholic Church, their color is white. If you look at the Pope, white airplane, the white roads, and how you see them, and all is associated with white. And they conquered a lot in the early, centuries. The Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the conquest of Central and South America, Mexico, was done by the Spanish and the Catholic Church. And then you look at red, and what color do you associate red with? You associate that with communism, a great sword, ability to conquer.
Who we do in our time, anyhow.
And then they look at black as capitalism, which is trading and stuff. And, capitalism, the United States of America represents the most capitalistic country in the history of the world and how we had our time. And if you look at green represents the Islam, but they have the green doors on all their, look at the green on their flags. Look at the green on the doors of their mosque and stuff. And it says death and hell and Hades follow close behind. And
I've never heard any of that.
Who are these? Okay, well, this is where something that I've heard that kind of just rings true still in my spirit and how it explains it.
Well, there's a lot of problems with that, though. White is the color of the Lamb. And white is the color not of the Catholic Church, but that all priests... where all priests, pastors.
You say the church. I'm just saying the church conquered without of arrow.
Yeah. Red. I mean,
red is communist.
No.
Is there flags red China?
Communism only existed for less than 100 years. I mean, it didn't exist then. And what about all the Lutheran churches that have red doors?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it has nothing to do with communism. I think that's a stretch.
What are spirits talking about in Zechariah that, that God sent forth? Isms, you know, Catholic, I mean, communism, capitalism, Islamists.
I've never heard that.
You never heard that?
Uh-uh.
Okay.
That's
interesting. But I mean, that's a current, that's a modern
thing. Yeah, that's a modern thing.
It never happened in when this was written. That was never even
thought
about.
No, there wasn't nothing, you know, to represent the green.
But you can make it whatever you want to make it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But if you look at who, if you look at the description of the pale green horse with death and Hades, you know, and conquered by the beastly men, and have a quarter of the world's population under control. What religion now, Islam, has a quarter of the world's population under control? The death and famine and stuff like that is mostly occurring in their countries. And the beastly men, you look at that, describes the ISIS people to a T.
Yeah, but I think you could pick different points in history and make and come up with a similar scenario. I don't. I mean, it's really easy to say, oh, that's what it is today. Well, okay, but that doesn't mean that's what it was at other times in history. And the other problem I have is that you're talking about the Greek word. Zechariah was written in Hebrew. So I'm not sure what the Greek word...
Revelation, the pale green, they call it pale green, but it was chloric force. And chloric, black grass, you know, the word chloroform comes from.
So you're saying Revelation.
In Revelation.
I'll have to bring my Greek book and look that up.
See if you don't see chloric. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else from the video specifically? All right. Well, let's go back and do chapter 4. And get ourselves in the books caught up to where we are on the video. Get the right book here. After this I looked, and there was a door in heaven standing open. The voice like a trumpet, which I had heard speaking with me at the beginning, spoke again. Come up here, it said, and I will show you what must take place after these things. At once I was in the Spirit. There in heaven stood a throne, and someone was sitting on it. The seated figure had the appearance of a jasper stone or a carnelian, and there was a rainbow around the throne looking like an emerald. Around the throne there were 24 thrones, and sitting on the thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white robes with golden crowns on their heads. Flashes of lightning, rumblings, and thunderclaps were coming from the throne, and in front of the throne seven lampstands, which are the seven spirits of God, were burning with fire. In front of the throne there was something like a sea of glass, like crystal.
What is jasper and carnelian? What does that do with them?
They're precious stones.
Now, jasper, isn't that great?
Carnelian is green. Jasper, I'm not sure. And no, I did not bring my geology books with me.
Somebody Google it.
Huh?
Somebody Google it.
A rainbow.
Oh, I hear.
If I could spell jasper, I might would. Look at it. I might be able to Google it. That's my problem.
An opaque, impure variety of silica, usually red, yellow, brown, or green in color.
It's pretty vague.
Is that jasper or is that?
That's jasper.
That's jasper.
And the picture they actually show is a red jasper. So jasper can be a variety of colors. What was the other one?
C-A-R-N-E-L-I-E.
Carnelian.
Carnelian.
Brownish red, commonly used as a semi-precious gemstone.
And Ruby's red, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a brighter red. This is a brownish red.
Garnet almost.
Again, it's opaque, whereas a ruby, you could actually be able to see through.
Yeah. It's sort of like a brick color.
Yeah. These would polish nicely, but you wouldn't be able to see through them. Right. Emeralds and rubies, garnets, you tend to be able to see through the thinner spots. These would be very difficult. So they're not crystal. Not crystalline, but opaque rock. This says, well, this just says, by referencing these precious stones, John shows that the halls of heaven are far more splendid than the best that Rome has to offer. God is the ultimate power, not the Roman Empire. So we're describing splendor. The details are somewhat irrelevant. I suppose for each time, you could take the stones that were considered most precious and have those. You know, we talk about gold. And of course, even today, gold's not our most expensive metal, our most precious metal. There are other things that we might consider to be, some days copper's more expensive, I think, especially if you watch what people steal.
Yeah, they steal a lot of
copper. What is meant by the invitation John is given in verse 1? After this I looked, and there was a door in heaven standing open. The voice like a trumpet which I had heard speaking said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after these things."
That sounds like an invitation.
Yeah, well, it is. What do you think is meant by the invitation?
It's open to all. Maybe they want him to spread the word.
Okay. Anything else?
Sort of like a, come up here and let me tell you what to do, or show you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the same thing.
Think of another invitation that you've heard.
That's the invitation to come right up and go and see.
Yeah, come and see. Yeah, Jesus said, come and see. So it's a similar invitation. Heaven and earth are not separated by a great gulf in the Bible as they are in popular imagination. Heaven, God's sphere of reality, is right here, close beside us, intersecting with our ordinary reality. How might this understanding shape the way we think about the door in heaven that John sees?
Seeing right there that it says
just
there,
whistling
everything
through the
is beautiful, uh-huh. Beautiful and rich and everything.
I'm sorry, Nancy, say that again.
I said what he's seeing there at the beginning is everything that is rich and beautiful and white and pure and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, just beyond.
Yeah. Yeah.
Imagination. You ever seen flashes of lightning, rumblings, and thunders coming from the throne.
So where is heaven?
He saw it when he was in the spirit.
Yeah, but where is it?
Be wherever it wants to be.
But it's everywhere.
Okay, that's not a bad...
They describe heaven somewhere up above. They always
doing that. Always think of it as up above, but when we get there, it's when we'll know. I got to put it. That's the only way. And of course, we think of heaven down too.
It says angels transport us to heaven whenever we die, our spirits. Right?
So you assume up.
So, yeah.
We tend to assume up. But
what do you think it might have something to do with some people say they've seen a spirit rising from a body that has just died? Well, and that's going up.
Well, the disciples saw Jesus ascend into heaven.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's plenty of things that would lead us to believe that it's up.
He didn't go down.
Well, and then the other question, of course, has to be, where's hell? Well, you know, we've explored heaven. I mean, the heavens. We've explored the core of the earth to some extent. We haven't found either. So they're obviously not physical locations that we can get to.
No.
And we can see,
but that doesn't make any difference.
We can see light from stars that's millions of light years away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can imagine the distance.
We've also heard Jesus say, you know, the kingdom of heaven has come near.
Like Dad always says, some people have their heaven here on earth.
I always heard that too.
And some have their hell here on earth. Mm-hmm. And we own plenty of those. So you know, we're not talking so much about a physical location as, and I guess this is where, particularly in the science fiction world, you really start to hear more about other dimensions. Because if it's here but not here, then it somehow has to be on a different plane, different existence, different dimension than what we are, or something. And maybe it moves, or maybe the barrier between the two is thinner at times, or who knows? Maybe all of this is just metaphoric language to confuse us. But
maybe there's more dimensions. We only see in three dimensions.
We have absolutely no idea. I've seen the fifth dimension.
Yeah.
They sing and dance.
Yeah.
But
you know, Marilyn really cool is right first.
But you know, we get pretty hung up on that physical location of heaven and earth, heaven and hell.
But thing is, our physical body is not going to heaven or hell. It's our spiritual body that's going to heaven or hell.
Yeah.
So if that was the case, then there shouldn't be a physical heaven or hell. You would, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And we also talk about, you know, we talk about ascending into heaven. Jesus certainly did. That's what we're told. And yet, one of the things in Revelation that we'll talk about later is that the new Jerusalem isn't up there. It's here. It comes down to earth.
Well, that's up there if it comes down.
Yeah, but it doesn't stay up there. I want to say it. It comes down to earth.
Right.
Jesus will reign here.
Yeah, didn't he say?
Did you see the size of the new Jerusalem? Well,
didn't he say there will be a new heaven and a new earth?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah. So, I mean, you know, physical location is something, I said, we tend to get hung up on, but reality is, we're kind of clueless as to where that might be, or how that might be, or how we go about getting there.
I think we're more than kind of clueless. I think we are really clueless.
Well, the way they describe the New Jerusalem is 1,600 miles wide, 1,600 miles long, and 1,600 miles high. You know?
Well, actually, they didn't use miles, but...
Well, the dimensions they use, if you try to convert that into miles,
yeah,
it's supposed to be 1,600.
Yeah.
That's a good piece of property.
What difference does it make to our everyday life of faith to embrace the fact that God's sphere of reality is not so far away at all? If heaven isn't way off up there somewhere, but it's over here somewhere.
Well, I think the older you get, the closer you get to heaven, is what I may well look at.
Well, he also says, if you do this to the least one, you're doing it to me. Where mm-hmm. am I? I mean, if you do something to your neighbor.
Yeah. And I think there is something to be said for the idea of heaven on earth, but also very much hell here on earth. Some people's worst hell are the lives they're leading. It can only get better. It can't get any worse.
Right.
I think we probably all have known some people who kind of fit in there. The invitation to come up and see what is going on does not, as some people have supposed, have anything to do with God's people being snatched away to heaven to avoid awful events that are about to take place on earth. It is about a prophet being taken into God's throne room so that he can see behind the scenes and understand both what is going to take place and how it all fits together and makes sense. Hearing that description of the throne room and then this question makes me think of the Wizard of Oz and Toto running back behind the curtain. Like some of the ancient Israelite prophets, John is privileged to stand in God's council chamber and hear what is going on in order to report to his people back on earth. Like Micaiah ben Imlah in 1 Kings 22, he sees God himself sitting on his throne with his host around him and is privy to their discussions and plans. But this scene too reminds us of Ezekiel 1, where the prophet is given a vision of God's throne chariot carried to and fro on whirling fiery wheels. The rainbow, verse 3 of our present passage, reminds us of that, but also takes us back to the story of Noah. Take a moment to read and reflect on Genesis 9, 8 to 13. So then that might be the story of Noah. Yeah. 9, 8 to 13. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "As for me, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the domestic animals, and every animal of the earth with you, as many as come out of the ark. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." God said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make between you and me and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth."
Did yours say, "I will set my bow in the clouds"?
Uh-huh.
Mine says rainbow.
Rainbow is what we understand it to be, but
okay,
yeah. But the word is actually bow,
like a bow and arrow. Bow?
No, like a bow on a Christmas package.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've always wondered why it didn't say rainbow in most English translations, because that's what we understand it as. But that's not the way they translate it. Why is it significant that John describes the rainbow as being visible in the throne room, encircling the very place where God is seated and rules over the earth? It's not where he keeps it when he's not using it, I don't think.
It's a reminder of the covenant.
It's a reminder of the covenant, exactly. It's a reminder of the covenant. And it sits in the throne room. Who sits on the thrones gathered around God's throne, and why are there 24 of them? That's a question I have.
Two for each of the tribes?
Well, that's the easy answer. Is it the right answer? Anybody got any insight on that?
Let's see that.
Did not get a chance to read ahead, Seth, today. I've been running back and forth between the dentist and the doctor, so.
There's 12 or 24?
24.
There's 24 elders.
24 elders on 24 thrones.
They
and they were
crowns.
Dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads.
I don't know about the whole number, but you would think his disciples would be there.
Twelve disciples and 12 tribes? Who's going to say that and give you 24?
Okay, commentators argue about the identity of the elders. Are they a species of heavenly courtiers like the sons of God who wait upon the Lord in the book of Job? Is there some memory here of the 24 orders of priests mentioned in 1 Chronicles? It is suggested the number of 24 refers to the hours of the day, but...
Are they angels?
Isn't the hours of the day man-made? That's not... That's
yeah,
the, that's
and not. I don't know, and I don't know how long 24 hours has been used. I know a bit about calendars when they came, but I don't know about the hours. It's probably marking the movement of the sun and the stars across the heaven. Babylonian astrology knew 24 special stars. The most convincing proposal comes from Victorinus, who identifies the elders as the 24 fathers, 12 apostles, and 12 patriarchs. So the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles.
That's counting Judas, though, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Judas was replaced, so I mean, there were still 12.
Okay.
Yeah, so... You know, it could be the original 12, or it could be the 12 who we hear about in Acts. 12 in Revelation is the ecclesial number applicable to both Israel and the church. So that seems to be the more common approach. 12 apostles and 12 patriarchs.
But like everything else, we don't really know.
We don't really know. I mean,
yeah, never will know.
And we don't, since we don't know much about John, we don't really know, what was he influenced by Babylonian astrologists who knew 24 stars? He knew what a Babylonian was, but did he know anything about their astrology practices? I have no clue. But the 12 apostles and the 12 patriarchs probably makes as much sense as anything. And it certainly... would follow Jewish numerology, where 12 is a significant number. Okay. Behind the ambiguous struggles and difficulties of ordinary Christians, there stands the heavenly throne room in which the world's creator and Lord remains sovereign. Spend a few moments contemplating John's vision of this reality. How does it help you to understand better our own present circumstances? What does it mean to hear this word that says that absolutely God sits on his throne and is in control? What does that mean to you?
The ruler of all. The ruler of all. Of everything.
Yeah. What does it mean on those days when it seems like everything's falling apart?
God's still on his throne.
Yeah, God's still on his throne.
He's still in control, but he also lets us make some bad decisions.
Sure, sure. But God is still in control. I think that's the key thing. It is said that one of the struggles in the church today is that people in general feel that their lives are out of control. You feel like that some days? You know, you got this part of the government telling you this thing, and that part telling you something else, and somebody else says, no, that's all wrong, you got to do it this way, and you just kind of want to throw your hands up and say.
Up until 2.5 years ago, that's exactly how I thought.
And so, when you're out of control, you desperately want something you can take control of. And for most people, they desperately need something they can control.
Yeah, but I think once you realize that you can't...
But they want a physical person to take control.
Well, or they want someone to take control of.
Yeah.
You can't take it out on your boss. They get you fired. You may have other organizations you belong to that you may or may not feel that you can do anything. But what's the one organization where one person can make a lot of noise?
The church.
And so people who feel completely out of control in their own lives for various different reasons, some real, some maybe not so real, some of them tend to lash out at the place where they feel that they can have some control. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But it's one of those interesting things that has been proposed is why so many churches are in trouble today. So many churches have bullies in them. So many churches have run off pastor after pastor after pastor after pastor. So many churches can't get new members because they keep running them off. It's because rather than being the opening, welcoming places where everyone should feel comfortable and feel safe, someone feels that that's the place that they can show that they have control when they have it nowhere else in their lives. Now again, that's a theory that's got some psychology behind it that may or may not always apply, but in my experience, I would say it's not completely untrue either. And again, you're right, George. Some people don't feel they have to be in control. And to me, and again, if you look at addiction as one of the places where people are most out of control, one of the truisms about addiction is that no one can help an addict until they hit rock bottom, until there's nothing else to lose.
They have to make the decision.
And then they realize that they are out of control and that they have to put their hands, their life in someone else's hands. Mm-hmm. And which is also why most addiction recovery centers are also, let's say, very spiritual, if not outright religious. Because generally that person that you have to put your life in control of is someone much greater than you, and it's not just your sponsor or the guy standing up front, it's putting your life in God's hands. But that doesn't work for everybody. There are some people who have to believe that they have to be in control. And
a lot of people go to their grave thinking that too.
Sure they do. Sure they do.
A lot of people do.
Well, you have some pastors that, I'm not thought off on here or not, but it's like some of these pastors that has their own church, their own building that belongs to them. They think that they're in control of everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I've known places, you know, just like the Klein School House, that where the preacher owns that building, he owns everything, he collects all the money and all.
Yeah.
He is in control.
Well, you know, and I've said that's one of the issues I have with non-denominational churches is they're primarily started by people who feel they have to be in control. They can't do what someone else says. The ELCA says that, you know, we shall worship in this manner and we shall abide by the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed and you know, those will be the shape of our faith. And some people will say, well, you can't tell me what to do. And what they do may not disagree with any of those things outwardly, but it's simply the fact that they can't let someone tell them what to do. And so they go off and start their own church.
Well, a little bit of human nature comes in there.
A lot of human nature comes in there. And this is where, as Lutherans, you know, we are a confessing church. And we confess that we are by nature sinful. And there are some people who are not willing to admit that. And so they go off.
They think they're above it.
They think they're above it. And so they go off on their own. And so many times we find out that something happens. A classic example has been in the news the last couple of weeks. Mark Driscoll has resigned as the leader of Mars Hill Church, which he founded. There were no financial improprieties, no sexual improprieties, none of the things that you might expect. The issues they had are simply with his management style, where he was in control. And some of those control issues are what got him in trouble. Now, they all admit that he didn't do anything that meant that they were going to remove him. But an article I read today simply said that we identified some areas in which we felt that Mark Driscoll, as the pastor, senior pastor of that church, needed to work on, kind of like, you know, your boss telling you that in your review that, an anger management class might not be a bad idea, or you need to learn to play well with others, or something like that. And apparently his reaction to that was to resign. Now, did he feel they were wrong and unjust? I don't know. The board of elders spent 1,000 man hours reviewing all of this, so I think they probably had thought it through pretty well. Does that mean that Mark Driscoll, part of his ego, just wouldn't let him submit to someone else's authority?
Sounds like it.
Very possible.
Well, he can run for a politician then.
Well, and politicians are another prime example. Where was I the other day? I was driving. And somebody with state motor pool plates, just flying down the road. It's like, and so it wasn't a junior employee getting up with a motor pool car. It was a senior employee who said, I got an ID I can flash. They won't write me a ticket. And most times they won't. But, that kind of ego has gotten more people in trouble, and many pastors, but also other leaders. Take Bill Clinton, for example. The man is brilliant. He did some great things. His ego got him in trouble. Well, I won't get caught. Or, if I don't, hey, I'm president. Who cares?
That was Nixon, too.
Yeah, Nixon. I mean, yeah, we have a few others who fit that, but...
For sure.
Yeah. ego is part of the human condition that really can get us in trouble. Again, realizing that we can be wrong, realizing that, when somebody says this isn't right, you need to at least hear it.
Every one of us in our work, at some time or the other, has basically screwed up and didn't want to admit it. Is that not true?
Oh, yeah.
I learned a long time ago, I can say, man, I don't know. We're pretty quick.
Well, it's like a lot of actors and actresses when they get into trouble. The first thing out of their mouth is, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
Same thing, you know, when they get into trouble of some sort.
What's his name? It was on 2.5 Men. Classic example.
Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
Classic.
Always somebody else's fault.
Classic, classic example.
Well, that was, like that other, not too long ago, actually, there was an actress.
Witherspoon got caught.
Yeah. She was drunk with her husband, I think it is.
Yeah.
The first thing out of her mouth was, do you know who I am? Yeah, right, okay, whatever. Well,
who's the young girl that's been arrested so many times?
Oh, Lindsay Lohan.
Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah.
I mean, just stand in front of the judge and say, I'm not going to do that? Really? In front of the judge? I don't think so. The judge didn't think so either.
He can make a believer out of you.
Oh, yeah. That's.
I think everybody knows who the Rolling Stones are.
Uh-huh.
Keith Richards got busted a long time ago with enough weapons for a small army, a couple pounds of heroin. They made him go to kids' hospital and play for them. Mm-hmm. That was his punishment.
That's why,
Everybody else would have got life in prison.
Yeah. And sometimes our treatment of those things makes that situation worse. But those are all issues. But this getting back to this, that image of God sitting on his throne and knowing that no matter what and no matter when, God is sitting on his throne and still in control. I think that should give us both pause, but also be encouraging. Let's see, verses 6 to 11. How does John describe the four creatures? Oh, that's the next part. We haven't read that yet. All right, hang on. Turn the page. In the middle of the throne and all around the throne were four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. The first creature was like a lion. The second creature was like an ox. The third creature had a human face. And the fourth creature was like a flying eagle. Each of the four creatures had six wings, and they were full of eyes all around and inside. Day and night they take no rest as they say, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, who was and who is to come. When the creatures give glory and honor, when the creatures give glory and honor and thanksgiving to the one who is sitting on the throne, the one who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down in front of the one who is sitting on the throne and worship the one who lives forever and ever. They throw down their crowns in front of the throne, saying, O Lord, our God, you deserve to receive glory and honor and power because you created all things. Because of your will, they existed and were created. Okay, now back to the question. How does John describe the four creatures?
Well, if you look at it from first to last, it sort of goes like from strongest to weakest. Okay, first one's a lion, next one's an ox, next one's man, next one's an eagle.
Okay.
The other thing I have a little bit of a issue with on verse 8, compared to your version, was mine says each of the four living creatures had six wings and was covered with eyes all around them, even under its wings. Yours didn't say that. Yours said, I think it said eyes around them.
Each of the four creatures had six wings and they were full of eyes all around and inside.
Okay.
And inside. Is that what you said?
That's what it says.
Full of wings and inside. Yeah, I guess you could say under wings.
I think the main thing is that they kept saying, holy, holy, holy.
Yeah.
Lord God Almighty.
Sounds
like a song.
Mm-hmm.
I know it.
No. They had to be the highest angels, right? As far as the ranking of angels, these going through.
Well,
they were created by God.
They were created by God, but that doesn't make them angels necessarily.
They're higher than angels.
Cherubim, seraphim are God's creatures, but not angels. So I don't know what name we give them. This says, the four creatures deserve our attention. They represent the animal creation, including humans, but at this stage, with the human-faced creature being simply one among the others, alongside the king of the wild beasts, the lion, the massive leader of tamed animals, the ox, and the undisputed king of the birds, the eagle. These remarkable creatures seem to be not merely surrounding God's throne, but ready to do his bidding. And in fact, as we said, worshiping God. Twice John tells us these creatures are full of eyes. What is implied by that image?
All seen and all tongues.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing's
missing. Yeah, and we know from like the insect world, I mean, that, you know, the certain insects with eyes all around literally can see and behind them. Like this says, in some early Christian traditions, the animals also represent the four gospel writers, Matthew the human, Mark the lion, Luke the ox, and John the eagle, are thought of as living creatures who surround and worship the Jesus of whom they speak. Of course, again, that's assuming that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John actually are the names of the four gospel writers, which we don't know for fact. But
it's also mentioned in Isaiah about... each had six wings, with two they covered their face, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew.
Uh-huh.
A vision that King Uzziah saw.
Right. Yeah, very similar. I mean, these are the creatures who surround God.
The same human.
Yeah.
Maybe he's remembering some of the Old Testament scriptures.
Very, very possible. Very, very possible.
It could mean that with all the eyes, you can't be anywhere, you can't be seen.
Mm. Yeah.
Conscious, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Some people don't have a conscience. That's the truth.
Well, yeah.
They don't.
Okay. Which of God's attributes do the creatures emphasize in their song of praise?
Holiness.
Holiness.
Lord,
yeah.
God Almighty.
Yeah. Who
is, and is to come.
Everlasting.
Yeah. It's a hymn of praise to the God who is and was and is to come. The song of these creatures is simply an act of adoring praise. We are meant, reading this passage, to see with the psalmist that all creation is dependent on God and worships him in his own way. That alone is worth pondering as a striking contrast to how most of us view the animal kingdom. But the contrast with the 24 elders is then made all the more striking. Creation as a whole simply worships God. The humans who represent God's people understand why they do.
Well, other than Jesus, the living creatures are the closest thing to God.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you got the 24 elders next.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the cherubim and seraphim? An angel?
Well, remember our... The preface in communion, you know, we talk about.
How does it read it? Can't remember.
Anybody got a bulletin for Sunday? Well, it wouldn't be this Sunday. Yeah, I don't print the preface in the bulletin anyway. But it always ends that that we, together with the choir of angels, the cherubim and seraphim. Yeah. So, I mean, actually, it distinguishes angels, cherubim, and seraphim as three distinct.
I didn't know it was a person, a big place, or something.
Yeah, the cherubim and seraphim are described in the call of Isaiah. Isaiah? Jeremiah. Which one has the coals on his tongue? Jeremiah. No, it's Isaiah. We hear of them again. When we hear talk about the Ark of the Covenant, the creatures that are carved on the ends.
Now Isaiah, his time was when the Babylonian captivity, right at the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
When he was the prophet. Did he go into captivity, Isaiah?
Well, Isaiah is written, the first part to the people in captivity and the last part to the people who are coming out of captivity.
That's what a 70-year period is in captivity.
Yeah.
On a regular computer, you might can see it.
It says the word seraphim means burning ones or nobles. They are also sometimes called the ones of love because their name might come from the Hebrew root for love. Seraphim are only fully described in the Bible on one occasion. This is in the book of the prophet of Isaiah, where when he is being commissioned by God to be a prophet,
yeah,
and he has a vision of heaven.
So I was right. It is Isaiah. But I did not...
We got that verse right in Isaiah.
It is. Tell me verses. There's a footnote, if I can find it. I don't see it. In art, seraphim are often red because of their names, burning ones.
They're red?
And that's what it says in art. You know, if you see a picture painting.
Well, you know, I didn't realize about the jasper and the other stone being that reddish, describing the color of God.
So what can we learn from this passage about praising God as creator of all things in our private prayers and public worship?
You have to believe it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Should believe it's true.
I don't know that anything in this passage says that, though.
He is creator and ruler over all things.
Yes, absolutely. And judging by the creatures who are there, what did God create us to do?
Look after it. He created us to look after his creation.
Yeah, but also like the creatures there, we are created to worship God.
To glorify God.
Yeah.
That's our purpose.
Yeah.
To glorify God. That's why he created us in his image.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got away from that, didn't we, Rick?
We sure did. I haven't done it all my life. I'm embarrassed, God, most of my life.
All humans are given the capacity to reflect, to understand what's going on, and in particular to express the understanding in worship. How might we be more intentional about allowing our thinking about God to inform our praise? There's certainly a topic we ought to be able to take off on. What do we hear in those few verses about worship? What should worship include?
Never say
everything. Everything.
And I said never ceasing.
Should be never ceasing, but our worship should be primarily about what?
Praising God.
Praising God.
Mm. That's what worship, the word worship means, yeah.
We should be praising God.
Right.
How many times do we hear people who want to do other things in worship that aren't about praising God?
You worship money, worship cars, worship other people.
Well, even the forms of worship we sometimes want to do. Where in some of those forms of worship do we find ourselves praising God? One of the problems I've had with some of the contemporary styles of worship, and don't get me wrong, I love a good contemporary worship, but I've been, there's a church out on the southwest side of Charlotte, a Lutheran church, that has always had contemporary worship. And I went a couple of times. And it was a great concert. And the people on stage might have been praising God. But we, the congregation, weren't given the opportunity to praise God. We listened to a sermon. We listened to the band play and sing. We didn't participate. So how do we, together, worship if it's just this group on stage doing all the work?
Well, you're saying they didn't participate. Were they given an opportunity to participate, or was just the band was too loud? Or I mean, I've been in a situation like that too, where the band was so loud you couldn't participate.
Well, there's two issues, and that's one. The other is that there's a lot of contemporary music that praise bands really like to play,
mm-hmm,
that's not singable as a congregation.
Okay.
It's not. I mean, yeah, say what you will, it's not singable.
I understand what you're saying.
And particularly the stuff that is very individualized. Some of the Michael W. Smith songs, I love them. I love to hear them. But you can't sing them as a congregation because there are parts in there where it's where the rhythm is such that it's very individualistic. Kind of hard to do that in congregation music.
Right. Sometimes it may go too fast.
Sometimes you go, the problem is when you know, when a phrase ends with a note that's held,
yeah,
congregations can't hold notes. They just can't. You know, a small praise band or a good performer can do that,
right,
but a congregation can't.
Some people get on the wrong verse too, don't be ready. Mm-hmm.
I did that yesterday at the Cedar Center, and one of the ladies sitting there,
Cameron and Karen forever get on to me. I do it about every Sunday.
Yeah,
I think you do a great job.
But you know, it's one of those issues. You know, how do we worship? And it really comes down to not so much how do we worship, but how well do we worship? Who do we worship? Why do we worship? I think those are much more key. Any style of worship done well is good. But we all have to be participants.
Well, you know, you're right in a way, because you know, this past Sunday I was at another church playing the instruments there, and the music was actually part of their hymnals, part of the hymnal songs that they sing.
Mm-hmm.
But as a band, when we were playing, nobody sang. They just, it was amazing. I couldn't believe it.
They tend to think of it as a concert.
Yeah, yeah. And they will, and after the, it was all said and done.
And the bigger the band, the less the people sing.
Well, that was the whole thing, I think, because after it was all said and done, a lot of people go, oh, you played really good. We liked your music. We were listening to it and everything else. But they weren't singing.
Yeah.
They weren't participating. They were watching us play.
Yeah.
And listening to us play. We had one guy in particular, he goes, I loved, because I was playing the bass, he goes, I love listening to you play the bass because I could sing to the bass. I could sing as a bass. And I was like, but were you singing? I'm saying to myself, were you singing, you know, singing the meaning behind the song?
Yeah.
You know, or just listening to me play?
Yeah.
That was
weird. Yeah, so that means, you know, that gets to be an issue. But, you know, that's part of what this is addressing is worship. I mean, what do we hear here? We hear the four creatures praising God without ceasing. And we hear the elders are joining in. And I think that's really what our worship is called to be. It's not about hearing a preacher talk for an hour. It's not about hearing a great band play for an hour. It is about us coming together to worship God together. And whether it's by responsibly reading psalms, responsibly praying together, singing together, but it is something we do together, and I think that's something key that I see here in this text. Now maybe that's because I'm the pastor and I'm trying to get all everybody to help, but you know that's what I see is, you know, it's all about worship, and it has something to say to us about how we worship. Other thoughts, questions? It's 8:27. I'd hope to get into chapter 5, but I think maybe it's quitting time.
That's cool. We'll be here next Christmas.
Yeah, well, we may.
Well, if it is.
There's only 17 more chapters.
Is that it?
Let's close with prayer. All creation worships God. We humans are called to worship with Him and worship Him with mind as well as heart, recognizing that He is worthy of all praise as the Creator of all things. Take time to offer thanksgiving and praise to God for the specific reasons why He is worthy of our worship, paying particular attention to the wonders of His work. O God, we give You thanks for this time together. We give You thanks, Lord, for Your description of worship. We give You thanks, Lord, for all that You have given us, for all of creation. And we praise Your holy name. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
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 That's a good thing, Pastor.
All right. So we got through five chapters. We got 17 more to go. We'll get there.
This is a very important chapter. You know, that description of heaven.
Yeah.
How you visualize it. That's how it affects your life and the decisions you make going forward.
Yeah. I think it is.
We need to move chairs.
We're gonna move this downstairs again.
I'd leave the table here. I don't know of any reason not to. But we might need the chairs.
If we know, we would need them in.
We don't have any extra chairs like this, do we?
Unless we're in the room down there, and I don't.